This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age Masterclass podcast with host Ben Morse. Episode 9, 1967 Part 1, with guest Tim Capel.
Hey everybody, welcome to the latest installment of Marvel Age Masterclass, the podcast that takes you year by year through the Marvel Universe with me, your host. My name is Ben Morse. I'm a professor at UNLV, University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I used to work at Marvel Comics for 10 glorious years, and I got to learn all about the wonderful history of that company. And now I am helping out Place to Be Nation's own Sarcastic Four as they go on a deep dive through the history of the House of Ideas. I have one member of the Four on with me each episode to look back tonight at 1967, Part 1, and I am joined by the ever-capable Tim Capel. Tim, welcome back to the Masterclass.
Thank you for that introduction, Professor Morse. We are now living in a post-Bat Dick world.
You know? I saw that today online. Good Lord, man. I went to my shop on Wednesday and wasn't sure what I was going to purchase. I kind of wavered back and forth on Batman Damned because I really like that creative team. But ultimately, I elected not to pick it up. Did you purchase the bat penis in question, Tim?
I did not. I wonder. There seemed to be some confusion over how explicit the panel in question is. So I saw.
Have you seen the panel?
I have. I've seen two versions, in fact.
Right.
One that is very unmistakably, yep, here we go.
That's
frontal.
It. Right.
And one that is, you would never know. It's heavily shadowed. It's like the way those scenes are typically done in comics.
Right.
And I'm not entirely sure which one made the stands. So
we'll have to investigate that.
Yeah.
We'll have to check it out. And maybe when we come back for 67 Part 2, we can get back into this. But certainly an exciting new addition to the utility belt.
Right.
So, Tim, I have a few questions for you before we get started here. Number one, less of a question, more of paying you a compliment on your recent Nanu 210 retrospective on Talking Pop, which I thought was a crackling good listen, and I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for that.
I expect to be invited on the eventual Melrose Place follow-up.
Right. Yes. Talks are underway.
Negotiations are in full swing.
In full swing. Yes. We need to come up with an acceptable quorum for sure. I'm not entirely certain that my co-host Jennifer Smith watched as much or had as much exposure to exposure. There's a word that comes to mind with
all over the place.
Or
bat penis, either way.
Man, we're just
going for it.
Right. But assuming she is an aficionado of that program like ourselves, we could take a look at that. But it seems like something that, much like that BH 90210 retrospective, it's rather inevitable. Like, it's going to happen one way or another. So, I mean, we cannot leave that one on the table.
Well, you can tell Jenny, if she does need to view any portion of Melrose Place. When I was in college, I definitely did on eBay purchase a full bootleg DVD run of the entire series, which I still have in my possession. So
bootleg,
happy to help.
Okay.
Happy to. Yeah, it's literally recorded off of E. So you get the commercials cut out, which is nice, but you still get the whatever was on before on E! News or whatever. You get a little portion of that. So
that's a nice little feel. That's a big deal because you also get the intact musical performances.
Yes.
And, you know.
Yeah, once Kyle opens his jazz club, you get all the you get all the stuff. Dave Cause, everyone. I work with the UNLV radio station on some projects, and they had Dave Cause, who's just some old jazz guy, on, and I knew him because he was at Kyle's club in the 90s on Melrose Place.
Yes.
So I felt like I contributed briefly to that.
Yeah. They also played a lot of Urge Overkill at Shooters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Very Shooters, 90s.
Shooters was the best.
Oh, my God.
I dreamed of going to Shooters. I based my entire visual look in college off of Jake Hansen.
Oh, dude.
Leather jacket, jeans, the whole nine yards. I wanted to be Jake so badly. Didn't have a motorcycle, though, so it didn't really pan out. The one other question I have for you, Tim, before we get started here is, now that Avengers Infinity War is out for home release, how have your opinions changed?
I have not seen it a second time yet. I'm not avoiding it. I do actually, and despite what I said, I think in our somewhat knee-jerk reaction show, I do want
to 7-hour knee-jerk reaction.
Yes, so. that was like two times longer than the movie itself.
Right.
I do want to go back and revisit it and just. I have bad feelings about the fact that I have bad feelings about that film, and I don't know that I'm entirely going to. I'm not going to do a 360. You know, that's. Or 180, I should say.
360 would put you exactly in the same place.
That's gonna really wreck my day all over again. So I don't see myself doing a 180 on my attitude towards that film, but maybe I will soften in my opinions a little bit, just knowing what to expect and appreciating the things that I have to acknowledge they did get right, and the things that bother me are just gonna always bother me, sure, but I don't know. I don't like that I feel the way I do about that film. So
it's strong words from a strong man.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Well, I guess we should probably start talking about some 1960s Marvel. There's other stuff we can talk about. I mean, we already covered Bat Penis. We already covered Melrose Place, and we covered Infinity War, which I always like to ask you about. So,
I could easily continue on any of these topics, but I guess we have
fertile ground here.
Yeah. Got to cast our gaze back to a more chaste and prudent time.
Absolutely. And what was more chaste and prudent than the world's greatest comic book magazine, recently returned to the stands? I have the first two issues. Have you been reading the new FF book?
I haven't. I think I will wait for a few to build up, check it out. That's kind of my strategy these days.
It's fair, but you did read the classic Fantastic Four issues from 1967, of which we have a handful to discuss. Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, still operating at full tilt. And where we start is with an epic saga. Basically, the return of Dr. Doom to the pages of Fantastic Four. And in some ways, I feel like this is the spiritual sequel to the Galactus trilogy, in the sense that it's the next truly big epic story, epic threat following the Galactus trilogy. Now, I teased my feelings on this story a little bit when I had Russell Sellers on for 1966, and we were talking about, he was finally kind of getting into Fantastic Four, and we were talking about the Silver Surfer, and I think we were talking about the fact that he didn't like the Earthbound Silver Surfer. He preferred the spacefaring Surfer.
Yes.
And my argument for Earthbound Silver Surfer, it comes a lot from the Stan Lee John Buscema series, which I enjoy, but it also comes a lot from this story. And my reasoning behind it is, I think there's something very powerful about the Silver Surfer sacrificing his freedom for humanity and basically having this naive view built on his interactions with the Fantastic Four, with Alicia Masters, of, humanity being this great, wonderful race with such potential, and then basically having his first exposure to the dark side of humanity, no pun intended, in his encounter with Doom, who comes to him as a friend, plays off his innocence, and then betrays him. And I think, to me, it leads to the most interesting surfer dynamic, that being a surfer who realizes, in a very nuanced thing, because it would have been very easy to keep him as just a pure hero, but moving forward, and as you go into his solo series, he's now a very conflicted figure who is not sure if he did the right thing by sacrificing for humanity. He maybe regrets his decision quite a bit.
Yes, this is going to become his new arc now that he is Earthbound. And I think there is value in doing that type of setup for this character. He's very much that fish out of water, right? Where if he's the you know, high-flying guardian of the spaceways or whatever, then, I mean, that's going to provide you with a lot of cool visuals, no doubt, depending on who you've got illustrating stuff like that. But having him just as a character, you can just wring a lot more pathos out of it when he's stranded on Earth. You know, it would be easy for Stan Lee to lean into that very wide-eyed naivete sort of thing, but he doesn't dwell on it too long. We have, in stories like this, these moments where the surfer is completely questioning his decision to basically make the sacrifices he has for humanity. He's going, was it worth it? Did I make a terrible mistake here?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting stuff. And I think it also positions, once again, Doom as being this ultimate threat looming over the Fantastic Four, in the sense that it would be easy, bear with me for a sec here, it would be easy to kind of say, now that we've fought Galactus, now that we've gone after a challenge of that scope, the old villains are no longer a threat, right? The non-powered lesser villains suddenly seem so easy. The Fantastic Four could say, like, you know, we saved the world from basically a vengeful god. How is a guy in a suit of armor going to give us trouble?
It's like, and they've raised the stakes too much.
Exactly. But I think it's brilliant is that immediately Stan and Jack say, all right, we're not going to shy away from this. We're going to lean right into it by putting Doom immediately into interaction with the Surfer and putting him on the level of saying, like, Doom's wits make him as big a threat as Galactus's sheer power does. Doom is a different kind of threat. He's a thinker. Yeah. He is clever. He is resourceful. And in the way Galactus is just this pure being of might that overwhelmed the Fantastic Four in some ways, Doom, at the end of the day, might be the more insidious of the two because of the way he thinks and because ultimately Galactus, he has no moral imperative. He's just doing what he has to do to survive. Doom has these conflicted morals of, you know, wanting to do these evil things. And it just breaks my heart what he does to the Surfer. I mean, as much as it makes for a great story and I think really sets the Surfer off onto some interesting things, it's heartbreaking. They really do a good job of ratcheting the emotion in this story to the point where you feel bad for the Surfer. He really is this kind of innocent guy who wanders into a bad situation, and literally the first person he encounters after the Fantastic Four screws him over.
It is deliciously heartbreaking, if that makes sense. Just in the way that Doom has become such that character you love to hate, and to put him up against such a pure soul in the Silver Surfer, just fabulous instant foils there, those two are. And, you know, we've talked at length as well on this show and on Marvel Age, the personal stakes that you always have with Doom and his encounters with the FF, which you're not going to get with FF versus Galactus. I mean, yes, big bombastic storytelling, absolutely, but Galactus just is not going to have the personal investment and the personal connection to these characters that a Doctor Doom does. So you can work with that too, and now he's got these godlike powers. So it's sort of the best of both worlds.
Yeah, very much the best of both worlds. And to your point, it also kind of, once again, shows the range of Fantastic Four under Lee and Kirby as serial storytelling, that they can do these epic stories and they can also do these very emotional, heartfelt stories. They can do both kinds of things. And what I like here too is, just as Doom is not on the same power level as the Surfer initially and has to outwit him, it falls to Reed in the Fantastic Four, where with Galactus, they basically had to, you know, pull a rabbit out of the hat and figure out any possible way to defeat him. Mm-hmm. With Doom, it's a matter of preying on his greatest weakness, his ego, and ultimately having him be the one to foil himself. As we'll see, I mean, this is a trope that goes throughout the years in Marvel. It's kind of almost, it's a familiar story, but I feel like if done well, it always works. And that's Doom getting ultimate power and then just not being equipped to handle it, whether you're talking about the original Secret War, the other Secret War, all the times
Secret Wars,
all the Secret Wars in which Doom has gotten absolute power and then just ultimately proves to be his own worst enemy. And that's how Reed and the Fantastic Four are able to defeat him. But what I like about this story, Tim, and I really just think it's great, is that yes, in the end, the good guys win, but you have a lot of collateral damage.
Yeah.
You have the Surfer no longer fully trusting humanity, and we're going to see a lot come out of that. And that's dangerous moving forward right. for the Fantastic Four and for the Marvel Universe, is that you had this great situation where you had this Silver Surfer who was happy, go lucky, and just, you know, thrilled to be on Earth. And now all of a sudden he could potentially turn. But you also have Doom having had a taste of this incredible might, of this incredible power, and that's going to come back again. So even though the FF, by the skin of their teeth, managed to survive this encounter, in many ways, they don't really win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I started to put on my, I don't know, kind of critical comics reviewer's hat and talking about this particular story. And I had to sort of stop myself. On the one hand, I felt like the resolution here was a little bit abrupt, and that, you know, Reed's MacGuffin that he whipped up kind of arrives just in time. It's, you know, saves the day. But I thought the cleverness of how that was done, where he's actually exploiting this Achilles heel that has been installed to prevent the Silver Surfer from escaping Earth, that Doom does not know about. Very smart, very cool. I like seeing that come into play. And, you know, I think that kind of makes up for some of the narrative convenience here. And I think the real reason I stopped myself is we've really approached a point where this series and some of Marvel's other stronger continuing books as of this point, 1967, are getting close to where you can read them like a modern comic. And and I have to remind myself, okay, it's not a 2018 comic. I shouldn't really measure it by that standard. I need to measure it against the expectations and, frankly, the other comics that were being published in 1967, which we're not getting the exposure to. And that's just sort of a lack of context. So, and I think that's, it sounds like sort of a backhanded compliment, but it is a compliment. I mean, that a 1967 comic, we're talking over 50 years ago, can even approach, you know, that level of sophistication.
Absolutely. I think that's more than fair. That's definitely a fair way to assess this stuff. I mean, some of it we've obviously talked about through the episodes. Some of the 1961, 1962 stuff obviously has not aged gracefully, even with FF.
Right.
Some of those early comics, you know, I think I've said before on this show, but they're more important than they are good.
Yeah.
Like, they're more influential than they are necessarily of high quality. By the time you get to 67, I think you're really seeing some quality work done. But yes, you do have to put it in the context of, you know, this was written in 1967. This was drawn in 1967. Society as a whole has moved on since then. There are some things that were acceptable back then, even in terms of storytelling devices, yeah, that we would never, yeah, that we would never swallow today. But the fans of this age, like you said, I think on a sliding scale, a 1967 scale, the resolution of the story is incredibly clever. Looking at it through the lenses of 2018 and decades more comics written, obviously we are a little skeptical because we're like, what? No, that's way too easy. That's too easy a way to get out. But no, I think you have to look at it that way. You have to put it into the proper context. And yeah, like I said, this is one of my favorite Fantastic Four stories. I love the Galactus trilogy. And this to me is the sneaky, underappreciated, like, little brother of the Galactus trilogy.
Yeah, it is. It doesn't get remarked upon as much, and I can see why, but mm-hmm, it is, I would say, aside, just next to the Galactus trilogy, I would say second best overall long-form story arc we've read from, sure, FF.
Yeah, I'd agree. I guess it's in terms of overall stories, it's your mileage may vary on this man, this monster, and where that stacks up.
Oh, yeah, that was another controversial take of mine, wasn't it?
Yeah, right. But you also disqualify that from when you said, you know, long form storytelling. That's a one and done.
Yeah.
And this is more epic stuff. So moving on from that to the next big arc of Fantastic Four, which is not as well regarded, and for good reason, we see the introduction of Blastar, the living bomb burst. As we say, it's like, you look, it's hit and miss with these Lee Kirby creations. It's like for every Dr. Doom, you get a Red Ghost. For every Inhumans, you get a Fearsome Four. And Blastar to me is the loser of the Negative Zone.
Yeah, he's not even the coolest villain of the Negative Zone.
Exactly. You get a Nihilus, who is a great visual,
yeah,
fantastic powers, and just very, very cool introduction. And then you get Blastar, who looks like a fourth world reject, who can make his hands explode.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not very good. I would argue that the best Blastar story ever told, aside from the one in New Warriors Volume 2, Number 1,
okay,
where he stands in for Terax, who is in New Warriors Volume 1, Number 1.
That's right.
And does a poor man's version of that story. The best Blastar story ever told was a War of Kings one-shot from the 2010s, written by one Christos Gage, author of the PlayStation 4 Spider-Man game, and basically telling a very personal, very heartfelt story about Blastar that was edited by a young Marvel staffer who, following this story, was not allowed to edit any more comics. So, yes, when War of Kings came out, and I don't know if you remember War of Kings.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
It was basically like, all right, we've done Annihilation. We've done Annihilation Conquest. What do we have left?
And I think I've read the story. I'm vaguely recalling it, but a lot of that stuff, I don't know, sort of washed over. Not because it was bad or anything. I have a terrible memory for...
I wouldn't call it bad. I would definitely call it tangential.
Okay.
What happened was, I was friends with Bill Roseman. Obviously, I had coworkers with Bill Roseman, who now runs Marvel Games, but at the time was Cosmic Editor for Marvel, and I had loved Annihilation. I loved the cosmic characters. He knew I loved the cosmic characters. So when War of Kings came about, there was an idea to do, this is when we were doing a lot of stuff with digital comics, like emerging, like digital comics was still a new thing. Mm-hmm. So we hadn't put like the full catalog up on what would become Marvel Unlimited yet. We put some comics up there. And then the idea was, there was this extra added value of comics that would come out as digital firsts, So they would come out on Marvel Unlimited or Marvel Digital Comics Unlimited before they came out in print. So I don't know if I pitched Bill or if Bill pitched me, but basically we came up with the idea that I had worked at Marvel long enough that they trusted me to know how to edit a comic.
Okay.
Which may or may not have been fair.
How hard is it?
And so I just tapped my buddies, Christos Gage and Jay Farber, and they wrote 4 one-shots featuring characters from War of Kings, and one was Blastar. The other 3 were Crystal, Lilandra, and Gladiator. And we actually told the origin of Gladiator, and it was actually drawn by Mahmoud Asrar.
Oh, wow.
Who, of course, went on to be a big star. Yeah. And I can't recall who drew the other ones, but I do remember that Christos really wanted to write a story about Blastar. And I said, go to town, man. And for the life of me, Tim, I cannot recall what that Blastar story was about because I care very
little. Well, I don't feel so bad now.
Right? I care very little for Blastar. I just think he's not a very imaginative villain. And that's pretty much all I have to say about that particular subject.
Well, I'm glad we could get a, of all things, Blastar personal connection out of you. Yes. So, excellent.
When we eventually get to Gladiator and Lilandra, I'll have more to say. But yeah, I mean, this is, to me, Blastar is not the selling point of this story. The most interesting thing to me about this story is the continued use of the negative zone. Mm-hmm. And Kirby really fleshing it out visually, and also Stan just coming up with this idea of this other, you know, this otherworldly realm that's not necessarily, it's not like, hey, let's go to the moon, let's go to Mars, let's go to another planet. Just the idea of this other dimension where the thing I always liked about the negative zone, and to this day like about the negative zone, is that Lee and Kirby basically came up with a setting with no rules.
Yeah.
So they could do whatever they wanted. You want to have like bug faced aliens over here? Great. You want to have a planet where there's like ravenous fish birds? Like, you can do that. It all exists next to each other in the negative zone, which has proved a great breeding ground for stories in the subsequent decades.
Yeah, and you want to have a Triton swim through subspace in the negative zone, anything is possible.
Well, we had to make Triton useful, you know?
Yeah, very much so.
Had to find a way that he was of use. That was probably Triton's shining moment as a character.
I think my favorite thing about that Blastar story, and I didn't mention this on Marvel Age, was...
Oh, this is exclusive content.
Yeah, exclusive content I saved for this show.
I appreciate it.
He discovered the concept of using his fists to hit things. Mm-hmm. Apparently just, hand-to-hand combat, punching fisticuffs did not exist wherever he was, you know, native to.
Yeah.
And he was not an expert. I mean, he didn't pick it up right away and got his ass handed to him quite readily by the Thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I enjoyed that so much. Like, he had never thought, oh, these fists, you know, I can make them explode. Check. I'm good on that. Or I could not make them explode and just use them as weapons as they are. So,
oh, Blastar. Yeah. Mm. Can't win them all. Can't win them all. You can't win all with Blastar. Moving on. More new introductions to the Marvel Universe. We get in one fell swoop the Kree.
Yeah.
Ronan the Accuser.
The public accuser.
I'm sorry, Ronan the public accuser. Please forgive me. I did not give his appropriate naming convention in the original way. Ronan the Public Accuser and the Supreme Intelligence.
Yeah.
Makes his first appearance. Now, of these three, here's my take. And I love at this point, you know, I'll never fault Lee and Kirby for continuing to create. At this point in Fantastic Four, about, you know, 5 or 6 years in, they could absolutely have just been playing their greatest hits. And, you know, a lot of people who go on Fantastic Four will play Lee and Kirby's greatest hits, and they'll just do the big characters. But Lee and Kirby, this far into their run, having already introduced the likes of Galactus and the Skrulls and Doctor Doom and humans and Black Panther and all these great characters, we're still trying stuff out, which I respect. The Kree, it's interesting how much mileage has been gotten out of the Kree, because they're really particularly held up against some of the other alien races in the Marvel Universe, like the Skrulls, like the Shi'ar. They're not as interesting, because they're basically just the idea of, what if there was this alien race that was really good at war?
Yeah.
And like had a super good army. They can't shapeshift. They don't have neat powers. They're just like, they have a great militaristic strategy about them. So I don't think they were reaching very deep when they created the Kree, but it is kind of fascinating the fact that they've lingered and produced a lot of pretty exceptional characters, both in the Marvel Universe and in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
And Kirby doesn't go nuts on them visually
at
or
all,
anything.
At
They're
all.
Just kind of, I mean, some of them are pink, some of them are blue. And I mean, yeah. You do have the Supreme Intelligence, but he's
the Supreme Intelligence is probably my favorite thing about the Kree.
Yeah. How can you go wrong with the giant cabbage headed tentacle bad guy? I mean, just, I mean, he's going to come up over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And you never get to that point where you're like tired of the shtick, because I don't know, it just always seems to work, because the visual is so striking of this one character, this one concept. But beyond that, I mean, they're just kind of nondescript.
Yeah, I think this is a case where Kirby, like you said, he didn't do much with the Kree visually. They are just, some have blue skin. So whoever was coloring the book is actually working harder than Jack. Not really. But
well, no, to your point, yeah. I mean, it's not like he colored them blue or pink or whatever. It's
right,
just...
exactly. Well, he might. Who knows? Stan, Jack, somebody said, you know, make them blue. They're not interesting enough. I do think visually, Supreme Intelligence is great. And I also, to Stan's credit, I think, even though it get fleshed out later, but just the idea that the race is ruled by this like collective intelligence.
Right.
So it's not, you know, it's not a king or an emperor or anything like that. It's just, hey, here is the smartest, almost, it's almost like a computer program, because he's, we'll learn more about his origins later, but basically he's all the collective smartest minds of the Kree combined into this being. And it does start the trail that what the Kree will ultimately be known for in the Marvel Universe, and that's that they kind of come and do genetic experiments and, you know, eventually find out that's where we get the Inhumans and that's where we get all these different weird races. But aside from Supreme Intelligence, I have a soft spot for Ronan. I think his best days would not come until far, far, far later, like literally like the 2010s.
Yeah, like the Annihilation type stuff.
Yeah, I think Annihilation made him an absolute star. And the reason it did was it played into the idea that if the Kree are this ultimate army, then Ronan is the ultimate soldier. And he's the type of guy who's loyal to his empire, even if they have completely turned their back on him. That, to me, is the quintessential Ronan. Ronan, the guy who will continue to fight. And he just has such pride and such loyalty, and just really, even though he's ostensibly a villain, just has all these great qualities that you're like, oh, wow, what a stand-up character. And he's really, they make him very noble. I don't think we don't see that here. He's just, you know, he's just the bad guy of the month. I think he has a great visual design. I think Kirby does a nice job with Ronan, just in the sense that he doesn't look like anyone else, you know, like it doesn't, he doesn't remind you of anyone. It's like, oh, wow, Kirby really invented this. The same way the Supreme Intelligence is unique, Ronan is unique. But from a writing standpoint, yeah, he's just the heavy for the Kree. And he'll be that way for several years.
He will. Yeah, he's much more functionary than he is character for, and that's surprising to me, just given the fact that he was a Lee and Kirby original. I mean, we're talking 1967 here. This is when the character's first appearance is, and as you said, not much is done with him character wise for a long, long time. And you don't have a lot of those Lee Kirby creations that sort of just sit on the margins like that for such a long period of time.
But that's kind of cool in a sense. I love that. And that really is, to me, the story of Marvel Comics and, you know, are all comic books in a larger sense. But Marvel Comics really is the idea that the Marvel Universe is full of these characters, some of whom have been mined to great results over the years, but some of whom are just sitting there waiting for the right story.
Yeah, and I think, you know,
Ronan's an example. Like you said, he's a Lee Kirby original. He's got a pedigree about him, but it took nearly, you know, 40 or 50 years for anyone to come up with a good story about Ronan. And now you look at the last 10 years, he's had a tremendous last decade. He was fantastic in Annihilation. He was used well when Jonathan Hickman was doing his FF and Fantastic Four stories. And of course, he's made the transition to movies, where he was a big enough deal to be the villain in the first Guardians of the Galaxy movie. He's going to be in Captain Marvel. So I think that's cool. The idea that if you're a fan turned creator or editor at Marvel, and who, you know, it's rare when someone who gets to work there did not come up as a fan, you might have your favorite obscure Marvel creation who, you know, for whatever reason, you like the look, or
right,
there was some quirk of the personality that appealed to you. There's no better example of this to me than the fact that for years, Dan Slott loved Squirrel Girl, and he would use her every time he got a chance, and it was totally just because he loved the old, like, Steve Ditko Squirrel Girl stories. But then he made her interesting enough that people like Bendis or people like Ryan North, Erica Henderson, could pick up Squirrel Girl and really do something with her, because they have a new appreciation for her because he had an appreciation for her. And there's dozens of characters like that who can literally exist for 30 or 40 years and then have their coming out moment, which I think is just delightful. I love when, and I love new characters, don't get me wrong, but I do like the idea of, and they did this on the DC side too, it's not exclusive to Marvel, just the idea of pulling from that deep bench and coming up with the right story for some of these characters. I know we're jumping into the future here, but I just think, to me,
yeah, it's unavoidable. I think
it's just part of what makes superhero comics and shared universes great, that there's always a character who hasn't had their shining moment yet. I mean, if you look at, honestly, look at Annihilation is basically that times 10. It's a bunch of characters who were not as well known until they were put in Annihilation, and then Nova, Star-Lord, Gamora, Drax, Super Skrull, Ronan, and all of them get a chance to shine. But this is not a podcast about how much I love Annihilation, because I could do that podcast.
Yeah, I think I could too. I would love an excuse to reread that, which Marvel Age is going to provide us
years from now.
A hint of things to come, yes.
Yeah.
Years down the line. We'll get there.
I handed to one of my students, so I have a couple students who are comics fans, and they'll come into my office, and I have all my hardcovers up on the shelves because, you know, professors are supposed to have books on the shelves. Unfortunately, I don't own any books. I own comics. So that's what I have on my shelves. And I had this kid, because, you know, these are obviously, they're much younger than us, and having experienced some of, even something like Annihilation was before his time, which is, you know, sad. But at the same time, a reality.
It's understandable,
for me.
Yeah,
it's a reality for me. So I gave him the first book of Annihilation, because I have the first book and the third book, and I gave it to him. And a couple weeks later, I was like, "What'd you think?" He was like, "It's good." He goes, "I don't know who any of these characters are," and I was like, "Yeah." I was like, "That's fair," but I was like, "You'll learn to love them." So anyways, final Fantastic Four story. That's obviously we've set our piece on Ronan Kree.
I think so.
Supreme Intelligence. The last Fantastic Four stories that you guys covered was the latest Fantastic Four annual, which features the introduction of another, I hesitate to call classic villain, but certainly one that has survived to this day.
Yeah.
And that's Psycho Man. You guys were not kind to poor Psycho Man on Marvel.
I don't hate him. I just, It sort of feels like if you read one Psycho Man story, you've read them all.
Yeah.
Just because his shtick, as it's been pointed out, is fear, doubt, hate.
Yeah. You run through it pretty quick.
Yeah. He never really gets that upgrade that you think is expected. But yeah, he gets the introduction here, but I think what stood out to me with this issue was it was just like that the guest stars kind of take over, and
right,
you had the Inhumans, you had Black Panther coming back, you had Reed and Sue really on the shelf. Wyatt, okay, can you talk to me a little bit about Wyatt Wingfoot?
So Wyatt Wingfoot was basically a product of a few things. Number one, just the kind of crappy supporting characters of the Marvel 1960s. You had the occasional winner. Obviously, Spider-Man supporting cast was great. I'd say Alicia Masters is a great supporting character. But for the most part, it was just everyone had to have the love interest and everyone had to have the buddy, right?
Yeah.
You get your Foggy Nelson, you get your Happy Hogans, you get, you know, just kind of these uninspiring best buddy characters. And of course, the Human Torch had to have, once he went to college, his best buddy, who was Wyatt Wingfoot. And there's not much to him other than that. He's just a guy who's there to be friends with Johnny, and he never really develops much of a personality. The most interesting thing he ever did, spoilers for future issues, is that he ends up dating She-Hulk for a while.
Yes.
But that's about it, man. There's not a lot to Wyatt Wingfoot. I think he's just kind of there. I will say I'd put him above, would I put him above Happy Hogan? Him and Happy Hogan are running neck and neck. Foggy Nelson gets a pass due to the fact that he'll get much better later. But as far as the other, you know, he's no Harry Osborn. He's no Flash Thompson.
I'll go ahead and put him above Rick Jones right now.
Oh, for sure above Rick Jones. No question.
It's,
I mean, he is the official Marvel Age punching bag, of course, is Rick Jones. We got to wait till Peter David gets his hands on Rick Jones in the 80s to get some really good Rick Jones stories. And even those are on kind of a sliding scale. Of just being better than the original Rick Jones.
Yeah.
But yeah, Wyatt Wingfoot, you know, he is what he is.
I think what throws me with him a little bit is that he's Johnny Storm's friend / I guess roommate in college. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to sort of do the Peter Parker formula with Johnny Storm.
Yes.
And have a supporting cast and a setting for him. And it just doesn't really work for this kind of series. I understand the motivation to do it, but it's like this isn't Spider-Man. Like, you can't really have it both ways. Maybe you could, but the way that it's been done thus far, what we've seen, I think, in the select issues we've looked at, it just hasn't clicked with him in the way that it does with Spider-Man.
You know what? I've never thought of it that way. And that's a really interesting way to put it. And I think what ultimately prevents it from working is the fact that Johnny Storm, like the rest of the Fantastic Four, already has an established dynamic to fit into. And that's the family dynamic of the Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
So trying to set up for him this whole separate life, even though it does make sense, you know, he's going off to college, he's having his own life, it just doesn't, like you said, it doesn't click in Fantastic Four, because we want to read stories about Johnny with Ben, Reed, and Sue. We don't want to read stories about Johnny with, you know, Dory Evans or Wyatt Wingfoot. So it's just like, it's there have been many attempts over the years to try to make Human Torch more of a leading character. He's never really taken off. He does well in the context of the Fantastic Four. I would say, honestly, the only FF character who has really broken out as a single success would obviously be, you know, Ben Grimm, the Thing, who's had a few really good series. He doesn't always have his own series, but between Marvel 2 and 1 and some of his solo books, he's had some pretty good stories. But yeah, no, I think I'm not going to expand much on it because I think you nailed it. Why Wyatt Wingfoot specifically, and on a larger sense, trying to break Johnny Storm out just was not a successful endeavor.
Yeah, I guess it just jars me more than that, seeing that type of thing done in FF than it does in other books, because it's not like that's the only series where they have the sidekick sort of random hanger-on type character, but sure. It's just more jarring there. The FF feel like they are meant for bigger things than... They just have loftier concepts that you're dealing with.
They feel just above it.
Uh-huh.
They feel above the kind of the Stan, and I'll pin this on Stan because I think it's more him than the artist, but the Stanley formula of you got to have the girlfriend, you got to have the best pal, you got to have the office politics or the school politics. He was very big on that. And I think honestly, that was a symptom of Stan coming up when he did, you know, in the Golden Age. When everyone had to have a sidekick and everyone had to have a girlfriend and everyone had to have a job. And as much as you see Stan and his artistic collaborators innovate in the 60s and break away and do inventive stuff like Fantastic Four, like Spider-Man, you still see Stan slip back into what's comfortable and familiar mm-hmm. once in a while. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going back to the old way of comic storytelling. And I think that's what happens here.
It's almost a reflex, you think. It's,
yeah.
For as much as he had made FF and the other books that he has really either created or innovated different from other comics, there are certain tropes that are
he falls back on.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a lot of Fantastic Four. There, it was interesting to hear Nick talk about it on Marvel Age that this is kind of the last big year of Fantastic Four.
It is. Yeah, yeah, you know, we've got like one more coming up in 69, I believe,
mm-hmm.
Looking at our reading list. And then, yeah, it's just one issue. And oddly enough, we don't have a somewhat notable first appearance, which I groused about a bit. Mm. Yeah. As I'm sure I'm going to do more as we progress through this thing, but we'll see where this reading list and this journey takes us.
Yeah, it's going to be weird leaving the FF behind. They've been such a cornerstone of Marvel, and it's going to be weird not having them as kind of the central book around which all the others revolve.
Yeah,
it's going to be very interesting to track how that changes. Because for those first 6 or 7 years, you know, FF is very much the center of the Marvel Universe. And it does shift as we get into the 70s. So
the 70s are going to be very interesting to me, because when I think of Marvel in terms of decades, as you said, the 60s really belongs to the FF.
Mm-hmm.
I think of the 80s as belonging to the X-Men.
Absolutely.
Kind of the 90s too. But
yeah, right.
It's, yeah. But the 70s... I mean, I've read a good bit, but it's probably the decade that I have the least actual experience reading stuff from going mm-hmm. into it. And I don't know that there's the one runaway flagship book with that kind of second generation of Marvel creators and, you know, the Bronze Age, maybe Spider-Man. But we'll see.
It's in the 70s are an interesting time for Marvel because I think it's really much more of a free-for-all.
Mm-hmm.
Because the 60s, it's really you have three guys and then eventually a few others creating all these characters and just kind of going nuts. Basically, what the 60s allows, the success of Stan, Jack, Steve, and their successors allows guys like Steve Englehart, Steve Gerber, Marv Wolfman, Jerry Conway, guys like that to really Jim Starlin to really kind of do whatever they want, in the sense that you're going to see so much stuff thrown against the wall. So many, like, you know, you'll see, you know, the Kree Skrull War in Avengers. I don't know if that's late 60s or early 70s. You'll see the stuff going on in Spider-Man with Gwen Stacy. You'll see the X-Men start to reconstitute. Yep. But you also, you know, the 70s, and not again, we're getting off track, but that's fine. You know, 70s is where we see stuff like Adam Warlock, where we see stuff like Howard the Duck, where we see Tomb of Dracula.
Defenders,
which is a completely off the wall concept in a sense. And we'll talk more about it as we go on. But the 70s are interesting. I think we're all in the same boat that, you know, we might have grown up in the 80s and 90s. We're kind of familiar with those comics. And I think we all knew the 60s by reputation.
Mm-hmm.
So even though we hadn't read it, we knew like what we were getting into. The 70s is really much, I think that's the blind spot for a lot of Marvel fans. Like I'm the same as you. I don't think of a particular book as having dominated the 70s. I think X-Men catches on pretty quick, but I wouldn't say it rules the 70s because it's not.
Yeah.
It's not really till 1980 that you get kind of their biggest moments.
Yeah, I mean, I know they come back in 75, but I don't think of even that all new, all different X-Men as being really a 70s book or 70s concept, even though
right.
so much of the good stuff really is. And that maybe is just owing to that it was ahead of its time. But anyway, the fact is, I mean, this is also going to be the writer-editor era, right? Where
mm-hmm,
it's sort of the inmates running the asylum.
Yes, so very much so.
I would bet that's going to contribute to it.
Yeah. So before we get there, well, I mean, we still do have a few more years. Still have 68 and 69
sure,
to cover and the rest of 67. Before we leave the first part of 1967, we've got two more characters to cover who share a book, and that is the anthology title Strange Tales.
Mm-hmm.
Some interesting stuff going on in Strange Tales, some creative changes. It's no longer exclusively a Stan Lee vehicle. Let's start with Doctor Strange. And Doctor Strange is handed off artistically, significantly. Marie Severin comes on board as the new Doctor Strange artist. And you have a few, correct me if I'm wrong, I think we have a few different writers kind of filling in on Doctor Strange, from Denny O'Neill to Roy Thomas, to a few different people trying their hand.
Yes, you had some scripters. I think it's
right.
all Stan plotting, but mm-hmm. you did have Roy Thomas scripting at least that first issue of Strange Tales with Doctor Strange that we mm-hmm. looked at. But he's doing a pretty dead-on Stan impersonation.
Stan Lee impersonation, right. I think that's what he knew how to do at that point.
Yeah, and I think that's why Stan liked him.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I feel like we've almost, I don't want to say done a disservice to Roy Thomas on Marvel Age, because he does come in so quietly. In terms of his contributions, his sort of early contributions, where he's there to kind of keep track of things in the office and help Stan as needed and banging out scripts. But as far as developing his own voice and his own plots, we haven't seen yet. We will be seeing rather soon, but he's a sneaky kind of presence, very important and understated presence right now.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. I mean, initially what Roy Thomas does is provides consistency to Stan's absence. He's able to write like Stan. He's able to do stuff like Stan. The interesting thing is he's definitely a fan of Stan Lee, and he's probably the first fan. That's what's interesting to me about Roy Thomas, is he's basically the first real enthusiast hired by Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
Like all the other guys who came in, all the artists, the Kirby's, the Ditko's, the Romita's, the other artists who were working with Stan, they were all seasoned pros who had come from the golden age of comics or not long after. So these guys were, you know, they were experienced men and women in the case of Marie Severin who had kind of cut their teeth in comics. Roy Thomas basically came in straight from the fan community. He was a guy who loved Marvel Comics. And in particular, as we'll see as we get into some of his more classic stories, we talked about Stan Lee growing up in the Golden Age. Roy Thomas is a huge fan of the Golden Age, and we'll see him go to it again and again, both his Marvel and his DC work. He loves focusing on those 1940s and even 1950s characters. But yeah, he doesn't break out right away, because I think he is very much there to fill in for Stan and to do his best Stan imitation. It's not until, I would argue it's not until his Avengers run when he gets Avengers Solo, and Avengers of course is a book that at this point no one cares about, that he gets to kind of spread his wings and show what he can do a little bit.
Yeah, and I really love the story about him initially getting hired by, I think it was Mort Weisinger with DC, and immediately regretting his life choice. I guess as one does when working for Mort Weisinger.
Yeah, 1960s and, DC was not necessarily a fun place to be.
No, but the thing of it is, it's so telling. Like, if he had just tried to stick it out, or even if he had said, to hell with this, I've made a fatal error in trying to professionally break into the world of comics, I can't do this, the entire comics industry and landscape would be profoundly different.
Absolutely.
Roy Thomas had not. And it was just like he goes across the street and sort of finagles an interview with Stan Lee, and it's like, okay, we're gonna do this. I think I just erred slightly in turning my focus to DC, but if these guys will have me, then yeah, I will look at those editor's notes for Stan and tell him what issue was what happened in which issue, and do some writing, you know, after hours.
You hit it on the head. I mean, the comics industry without Roy Thomas at Marvel is a very different comics industry. He is in many ways the forgotten man, because he does come so soon after Stan. It's like it's Stan, it's Roy, it's a few years of instability, and then eventually get to Jim Shooter, which we'll get to on this podcast. But Roy is really the guy who, once Stan is starting to drift a little bit and Stan's getting more into the college speaking engagements and, you know, being seduced by Hollywood a little bit, Roy's the guy who keeps the ship steady. And it starts here, but it doesn't really fully come into effect until a few years down the line. I do want to talk about the character of Doctor Strange a little bit, and specifically Doctor Strange without his creators, which to me, he stands out as a character who really does not age well without his original creators. To me, Stan was great on Strange, but more than that, and with all due respect to Marie Severin and everyone who had come afterwards as a Doctor Strange artist, Steve Ditko was so much more than Doctor Strange artist. He was really, you know, the, in many ways, the creative force driving Doctor Strange. And I've kind of hinted at this, but to me, those early Doctor Strange stories work really well because he's separate from the Marvel Universe. And even the story we read for 67, he's still pretty apart. It's not like, you know, Spider-Man's dropping in or anything.
Yeah.
But you see him start to move closer. You mentioned the Defenders. And of course, other things are going to tie him more closely to Marvel Universe. And to me, when you make Doctor Strange just another superhero who happens to have magical powers, that's the least interesting Doctor Strange. My two favorite Doctor Strange stories of all time are Roger Stern and Mike Mignola doing Triumph and Torment, where he has an adventure with Dr. Doom.
Yeah.
And then Brian K. Vaughan and Marcos Martin doing Doctor Strange the Oath, which I would argue is the most successful Doctor Strange superhero story of all time, because he is very squarely in the Marvel Universe, using aspects of the Marvel Universe and functioning as a hero. But to me, he becomes kind of a rudderless ship for a long time, and even somewhat to this day. The most recent Doctor Strange stories, you know, no less than Jason Aaron, who's probably my favorite modern comic book writer, failed to make me interested in Doctor Strange. That was basically just my hot take on Doctor Strange. It has very little to do with the issue from 1967, but I figure we're not going to spend that much more time with him. So I figured now was kind of the time to make a definitive statement on Doctor Strange.
Yeah, that's fair. He does, when he works well, he does work really well, but the appeal there is pretty limited. And it is unfortunate that, and I don't think I'd argue against either of those two great stories that you put up as probably the best. Granted, I am far from even having like an associate's degree in Doctor Strange continuity.
Yeah, but I think a lot of people are in that boat.
And maybe that will change as we go through this. But you're right. I don't think we'll spend a whole lot more time with him. And right. I will say that this particular story we looked at, it felt somewhat like an extended epilogue of that.
Yeah. It's kind of the Ditko, last gasp of the Ditko era.
Mm-hmm. That Dormammu epic. And, yeah. You know, we got to enjoy some of that Marie Severin art.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Living Tribunal, who is just...
Oh, yeah. Let's not skip over the Living Tribunal. I do love me some Living Tribunal. I love any weird, super powerful cosmic Marvel characters because, to me, they're weirder than DC's. DC's are a little more straightforward. You know, we just have, like, cosmic gods and whatnot. Over at Marvel, we have a guy who looks like the universe and a dude with three heads. It's like that's the Marvel pantheon of cosmic characters. And I do think Living Tribunal, that's definitely a lasting contribution, particularly by Marie Severin, of the visual and of the character as well.
In terms of that visual, the thing about him, of all things that I'm going to call out, that I think was the most striking and unsettling at the same time are his hands. Now, follow me here.
Yeah, here you go.
It kind of looks like he's wearing mittens. he doesn't really have fingers. And the thing of it is you know, you figure this is one of these higher order beings. He can look like whatever he wants to look like. And he's just sort of doing this crude approximation of a human being for the sake of, I guess, interacting with humanoids. And I don't know, it's a great shorthand for just how much distance there is between what he is and what we are.
Yeah.
That, you know, he doesn't even really put the care into, I'm going to just look like a person. He's like, this'll do.
Yeah.
I'll
look vaguely like a person.
Yeah.
I don't really understand.
Close
fingers.
Enough.
Yeah.
Right.
That's great. That's a great take on the Living Tribunal. All right, Tim, I want to wrap things up with,
yes,
a character you guys really had your say on, and that is, of course, poor Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. 67,
poor
big
us.
Year. Yeah, poor you guys. It's a big year for Nick Fury, 67, because finally, Jim Steranko arrives to kind of take the reins. Now, at first, we still have a little more Lee Kirby, then we have a little Lee Steranko, then we finally transition to just Steranko. And the reason I think almost immediately a different take on Nick Fury works is, to me, the problem with Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., as written by Stan Lee and as drawn by Jack Kirby, was they had this attachment to Fury as kind of this alpha male action hero, who could never look bad and always had to be the toughest guy in the room and always had to be so cool and just, you know, just such a badass. I think it took someone who wasn't as close to the character to recognize that he worked much better as a guy who's in way over his head, as a normal grunt from the army who is suddenly trying to play secret agent. And almost from the jump, I think Steranko nails the idea that Fury's a pretty simple guy.
Yeah.
With pretty simple values, who is suddenly thrust in to an incredibly complex landscape where he does not understand what's going on, and it basically makes him crazy. He almost immediately becomes paranoid. Everyone's out to get him. He can't trust anyone, and he just doesn't know how to operate. I think the thing about Lee and Kirby's Fury was, even though he had no reason to be, he was immediately so good at being a spy. Like,
yeah,
he was just, he just, because they loved him so much that he just succeeded at everything. Steranko's Fury has a little more character to him. a few more flaws and struggles a little more. And I think that's what starts moving him in the right direction of being a much more interesting character.
And what you described about Steranko's Fury is exactly what I wanted to see from mm-hmm. that character from the contemporary 1967, let's say, right. version of that character from the jump. And the fact that we didn't get it was so very frustrating to me, because Lee and Kirby had already done Sergeant Fury and the Howling Commandos. Like, that was yeah. going on at the same time. And when they're basically just doing the same thing, but in the 60s now, is just like, no one wants to read this.
Yeah.
So it was unfortunate. And I feel badly that we weren't as high on these, you know, early Steranko issues as we were, because it feels like it's a knock on him, and it's not at all. It's just,
no, I mean, he has to find his legs, you know?
Well, yeah. And I think he started off pretty handcuffed, where
absolutely
that one issue, I swear to God, it felt like, I don't know, Stan was either, I don't want to say paranoid, but maybe a little bit insecure about handing over the reins fully to someone who was so untested, which Steranko absolutely was,
mm-hmm.
and just showers that story with so many text, so much text, so many word balloons, that it is like almost impossible to read right. and follow.
Well, I think you saw Stan at his worst there. Just kind of yeah. the insecure, like you said, insecure is a good word for it. Just someone who wasn't ready to let go of his character and really just overcompensated by doing, you know, the one thing he knew how to do, which was write. So I wouldn't pin those early kind of false starts on Steranko so much as once he got handed the ball, I think he almost immediately shows what he can do. And to me, the pinnacle of that, the kind of shining moment of the early Steranko run, is the Baron Strucker reveal
yeah.
as the boss of Hydra, which I think is great. Finally gives Hydra a face and finally makes for an interesting personal dynamic between Nick Fury and his bad guys, whereas before it was just, oh, you know, the generic spy world bad guys. Now this is someone who has a connection to Fury, to his past, and can really antagonize him. And now you're going to see, particularly in 68 and 69, I think we're really going to see Fury and the Shield Strip take off. And in large part because they have a great villain now, but also you're going to start to see Fury get fleshed out, his supporting cast get fleshed out, and just this world Steranko creates for him where he's not instantly successful. He's not the best at everything. He doesn't just figure out how to be great. He really has to adapt and figure stuff out. And it's actually a pretty cool hero's journey that I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, and that'll be coming up. I hope we're reading those issues. Gosh,
that would suck somewhat... if you don't. That would be quite a cruel tease to make you guys read all these Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., Lee Kirby crap fests, and then not give you the good stuff. That would be horrible.
Okay, to my great relief, I can confirm that in 1968, it'll be in part two, but, I mean, this is all public information. It's not a scoop or anything, but I just want to...
reassure the public?
Yeah, reassure the public that Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., issues 1-3 will be covered.
Excellent. And I can't wait to get to those. But with that, Tim, unless you have any parting thoughts, that takes us through 1967 part one. I think we got some good insights into what was going on. Any parting shots? Anything you want to say before? Of course, you'll be back for part two, so we'll get to talk a lot more 1967. But what did you think of the year as a whole?
Well, I haven't actually, as of the time of this recording, I have not finished reading the issues we have out in front of us for 67, where you will be hearing 1967 Part 2 on Marvel Age by the time that this episode drops, but as of this time, I have just a couple issues left, but I would say I'm pretty much digging it.
Yeah.
There haven't been as many new creative voices as maybe I thought or hoped I might see, but look, I mean, that's just a matter of patience. we're going to be getting there. And yeah, we will do it again shortly for part two, which is quite the mixed bag mishmash of stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot in part two. I was actually kind of surprised listening to part one. I was like, oh, wow, they just did FF and Strange Tales. That's going to leave a lot of other stuff to cover in part two. But
kind of did the heavy hitters up first.
Yeah. Get the big stuff out of the way and then kind of rapid fire the rest. I think we had it was similar in 1966, you know, the big FF and Spider-Man stuff first, and then let's talk about everybody else. Do we get, I haven't looked at the list yet, do we get more X-Men in part two of 67?
There is one issue of X-Men in 67. Nice. Yeah, I'm grousing a little bit over our selections.
Sure.
We're not at a point of having any controversial debates within the Marvel Age inner circle or anything, but I don't know, man.
Some of this
material is a little bit suspect, but it's interesting. List is the list.
It's interesting to say the least. All right, Tim. Well, until people can hear you on part two of 67 for Marvel Age, and of course back here for part two of 67 on Masterclass, you've got a lot of other irons in the fire. So where can people find and listen to you?
Okay, so also on Place to Be Nation, I do Talkin' Pop, the aforementioned Talkin' Pop with Jennifer Smith. Our most recent episode was the Beverly Hills 90210 retrospective, which, Ben, I'm so well glad received. To hear you are a fan of. Received.
I was probably more of a fan of you guys' podcast than I was of the original show. So there you go.
Wow.
I really enjoyed listening to it, and I was only, at best, a casual watcher of 90210.
Ah, I did not know that. Okay. Yeah. I was pretty locked in for a good while there. But that is our most recent episode you can find on this very same podcast feed. Mm-hmm. We will have another episode coming up. Not going to reveal exactly what that is yet. It may be a somewhat unique situation, as we say, on Place to Be Nation. Look for that, I would say, in the next week of this.
Nice. Something to look forward
to. In a few days.
Yep. Okay.
And that's all I think I will plug at the moment. I mean, of course, listen to the Marvel Age podcast with myself, our intrepid leader, Nick Duke, Russell Sellers, and manager, Todd Weber. You're never within really more than a week or two, although scheduling will get somewhat erratic in probably October, November. But we're trying to, you know, keep churning through those episodes of Marvel Age.
If you're not listening to Marvel Age and you listen to this podcast, it's probably very weird.
It would be.
So I would suggest going and catching up on Marvel Age and getting under. I mean, we're basically doing a reaction show to Marvel Age, so I don't know why you wouldn't be listening to Marvel Age itself. But hopefully everyone who's listening to this show is also listening to Marvel Age. As for me, this is really my only podcast feature at the moment, but I am very active on social media, on Twitter at Ben J. Morse and on Instagram at Ben Morse 882. You can find me, you can interact there. Of course, also follow PTBN Comics on Twitter and go to the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, where we are happy to talk comics with you guys.
Well said.
Well said. And you're on Twitter. You didn't mention that.
I am on Twitter at Cyke68, Cyke68. I haven't been tremendously active here lately, but perhaps that will change.
We'll see if we can drag you back out into
if you can drag me
into the harsh light of day.
Yes, back into comics Twitter. The
very scary
sometimes,
place.
Yeah, sometimes very scary.
It's been a really scary place for the last few weeks, but that's neither here nor there. We'll talk about that some other time. Tim, it's been great having you on. It's been great talking 1967 with you. I look forward to having you back for part two.
Cannot wait.
Until next time, class dismissed.
Hi there. Have you recently gone through a crisis? Did you find out your friends had been lying to you for years to cover up something they did? Have you discovered that one of your bitter enemies might actually be three people? Were you seemingly killed by a new god only to find yourself quantum leaping through time until you make it back to the present? Was your entire reality wiped out in a cosmic battle between two godlike beings only to be reborn, destroyed, and reborn again? Then join me, Russell Sellers, and my special guests as we help you manage your post-crisis life in DC Post-Crisis Management, a limited monthly series starting in September. We can't promise you closure, but we will try to avoid destroying your hometown and turning you into a homicidal maniac who wipes out time.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place for Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceforNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaceFormation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceFormation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceFormation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.